Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below. Finally, an update interview with Russ Konzer of Standard Soil. Our first interview we did 3 years ago, and I really, really enjoyed it. I think it's one of the longer ones we did, 1 hour and 22 minutes. And we discussed so much: beef, birds, methane, soil, shell, fossil fuels, and why regeneration is inevitable. This time, we look at an update of Blue Nest Beef, Standard Soil, where the industry is going, why wholesale is so interesting, and we go deep into the science of regeneration. Russ is involved in a lot of science projects around measuring soil, plants, seeing how they breathe, measuring carbon, water flows, water vapor. And of course, we touch upon why Russ is still very optimistic about the potential of regeneration. So much has happened in the last 3 years, so buckle up and enjoy. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the Planet Mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt/soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag, or find the link below. Today we have, I mean, more than a check-in interview, but it's been almost 3 years since we had Russ Konzer on the podcast. So much has changed in the world, and so much has changed for sure in regenerative agriculture and food. So I'm very happy to check in. If you haven't listened to the previous one, I would urge you to do it. I'll put a link below in the show notes. It was one of the deeper ones, one of the longer interviews as well. I think it hits like 1 hour and 22 minutes. So if you're up for that, you can always speed up. Pro tip, you can always speed up the interview. But I'm so happy to have Russ back here with us and to share the things he has worked on, has seen, what has changed, what has surprised him, and all of that good stuff. So welcome back, Russ, on the show.
Kuhn, it's wonderful to be here. Always fun to talk with you.
And I mean, there's so much to unpack in the last few years, but let's start with a basic introduction for whoever didn't click away and hasn't listened to the previous episode. Who's Russ Konzer? What brings you to the soil space? Because you have an interesting background. And if you want to go really deep on that, I urge you to listen to the previous one. But just a few minute intro, what brings you to the space and gets you so excited about birds, beef, and soil?
Yeah, well, as people hear my comments, I'm originally educated as an engineer. I spent 30 years in the oil and gas industry. Ooh, first half of that, taking carbon out of the earth, then investing in innovation for alternatives. And as I was retiring there after a 30-year career at Shell, someone came to me with this preposterous idea that we could sequester carbon in soil. And I tell people my world changed when they showed me a sample of soil under a regenerative farm. And I go, I know what that is. We call that a source rock. If you bury it deep in the earth for millions of years, it'll turn into oil and gas. And so suddenly, this potential climate solution seemed very credible. I got involved with a lot of farmers, really set as an objective here, how do we scale the impact of regenerative agriculture? We formed an enterprise called Standard Soil. Out of that, we started a company called Blue Nest Beef, bringing bird-friendly beef to American consumers. And I'm still actively involved in science projects, chairman of an organization called the Grass-Fed Exchange. And I guess that's kind of a whirlwind tour of where I'm at, and probably people will catch a number of perspectives as we talk today that poke through on various aspects of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember we went deep into the methane piece last time, And I definitely
want to double
click on that and see where we're at. But let's start with Blue Nest Beef, because it just launched last time. I think you were a few months in. And of course, it was right at the first wave of COVID, or the first ends of the first lockdowns or things like that. So people were ordering online, but it was also, let's say, you weren't completely ready for that yet to ship and slaughter and all of that. So how is Blue Nest Beef doing as we speak now, let's say beginning of spring, depending on where you are, Northern Hemisphere, but let's say April 2023?
Yeah, so Blue Nest is still here, but COVID was quite the roller coaster in that system. Probably shortly after we spoke, before we had our first supply chain challenges, as distribution really became a challenge. FedEx and UPS trucks in the United States really were failing on delivery. We re-engineered our supply chain and got that working again. But the initial surge that came through for distributed direct-to-consumer frozen meats was more challenging. Once people got past the early meat panic of COVID, that came in very helpfully. And importantly, we introduced we jumped from the frozen meat category into snacks, CPGs. We introduced a naturally fermented snack stick called Bubble Link, named after a grassland bird that and catching a little bit double entendre with the word link and sausages to have a really flavorful snack that has a good story for what it's doing in conservation behind the scenes. And by the way, I mean, I keep them in my truck and my briefcase on my desk, and to have a healthy snack that I can feel good about that's helping the planet at the same time has been wonderful. Of course, from a business perspective, it's also simplified distribution, because now we can ship dry without ice. We've started in some very small bricks and mortar retail system, still exploring and yet to really penetrate too far there yet. But that's all there. I'll tell you, it's still a challenge. I've learned that I'm a better scientist and strategist than I am a marketer. I really just come to admire and respect all the people that are just really good marketing experts in bringing the story of regeneration to products and getting it to consumers. So I would say within the Blue Nest, we're really glad that we started that. It's given us a lot of visibility that's opened further doors for larger opportunities. And I'm sure we'll talk about that. So that's kind of the Blue Nest update.
And so then let's say walk over the bridge you just opened into larger opportunities. What do you see as exciting opportunities to get this climate, let's say, positive beef and definitely bird positive beef into onto more plates?
Well, more than bird positive beef. I mean, I couldn't, in fact, I probably believe more strongly in the cause of biodiversity and how we can regenerate bird habitat, and how, you know, my scientific mind is like, if I was going to invent a perfect sensor, I would give it feathers and wings, and I'd create a whole bunch of different species, so there's one for everything. And the birds are just a wonderful indicator. But I think we probably talked about this in the original thing, because it was so fundamental in my thinking. The process of credibly and affordably counting carbon and other quantifiable attributes that we can assign to things is more complicated. So in many ways, the bird was an early surrogate for regeneration, and our partnership with the National Audubon Society was a way to open that door on that system. But it wasn't, you know, the only goal. I'll put it that way. It was a goal in getting something out there. And you know, we knew from the get go that it's just horribly inefficient to ship boxes of beef with ice that thaws in shipment around the country. So once again, my engineering hat here, thinking this stuff through, I'd much rather ship a container load of frozen beef than a little box that's thawing on the back of a UPS truck all the time. And, I'm not ready to name names yet, but we're in the process of developing some material relationships with large retailers.
And did they come to you, or you go to them? And why is that
connection. It's a bit of both, but it's a bit more folks that started out by coming to us.
And what are they looking
for? Usually for other people that noticed us. Yeah, exactly. Once you become visible, people say, well, how do I get that? How do I get it bigger, right? And again, backing up into the whole purpose here, when we started Standard Soil, under which Blue Nest Beef was our first enterprise, the big idea is how do we bring scale to the system? So Blue Nest Beef was just a way to start something to get it going. But what I care about is not the box of beef. I'm not trying to sell a beef from my farm or something else. I'm trying to bring regenerative food to American consumers and make it accessible. But the goal is to get more and more acres under regeneration behind that production system, right? So like even in the introduction of the snack product, the Bubble Link, a key part of that was instead of having to have a high quality grass finished cow that had well marbled ribeyes, they're all still the same grass fed genetics and system. But now the quality, I don't need a well marbled ribeye to go into a beef stick, right? I use trim and grind. So that means I can not only have lower costs, but I can tap more acres, right? The animal, the farmer doesn't need perfect genetics and perfect grazing forage chain to get that high quality product. So it's a very practical approach in getting there. And the same thinking then translates into going to wholesale, which is okay, rather than, shipping a small number of boxes around the country, how do we ship a regular schedule of large containers of meat that carry the same attributes, that have the same production practices associated with them, but now we're maybe something evolves in here that it would take us otherwise, so I'd never want to say no forever on it, but I'm much more interested in creating a wholesale supply chain for somebody else's branded product than my own branded product in this system, only to use it as a surrogate in the system within our own team. I'd rather than have McDonald's introduce a regenerative Big Mac, I'd rather make sure that the Big Mac has more and more regenerative beef content in it over time. And so that kind of thinking is the way we think about developing the wholesale business. I think you had a guest on here a few months ago that had the insight of going on into wholesale.
Riley, I'm permanent.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. And we've had the same basic insight, is how do we get from this direct branded product and not that's not bad. There's nothing wrong with that. We should
but
do
it's
more
limited
of that.
And it's a specific
but it's
scale.
Limited. How do we if we want to scale impact, we got to figure out how to plug into and tap existing infrastructure and supply chains and products.
And speaking on that, does it mean on like the slaughter side, like how challenging is that to fill a container, just to say with a container or larger quantity? Is that very different than what you need now for the boxes, or you say actually it's much easier because we don't have to fill individual boxes, we just fill a much bigger box?
It's much easier. I mean, the type of wholesale products that we're developing are largely simple products as well. So I don't need excellent packaging and fabrication, labeling. It is much easier. I've got a lot more options available as we develop these opportunities with wholesale, for sure.
And you hear a lot in the US, but I don't know the details, that let's say the number of slaughter facilities is really a challenge, for especially with the distance to farmers. And we talked a bit about it last time, but of course stuff has changed in and after COVID. Is it a challenge where you work for your farmers or your ranchers, that it's far and difficult to get slots, or actually not that much as you?
Well, I've got partners in here that know that sector really well, and that hasn't been a barrier. And indeed, it was a tough lesson in COVID. And I'm not going to name names, but we ended up having to do one load at a different slaughter facility because of the backlog. And I learned that it was a very painful price to pay for quality of the product. But when you go to wholesale and you're developing ground beef and trim for mass market products, that doesn't matter as much. So slaughter facilities are many more options. And one of my partners, Bill Godfrey, now has his own processing plant that opens up options for us here that we didn't we didn't have before. So it's not the barrier for us now. It may be in the future, but and if you're, what I would say is in the direct to consumer, when I want to present to the consumer that well marbled grass fed ribeye in a nice package, it's consistent, it looks good. There's only a few people that can do that really well, in my view. But as I get to wholesale, I think those things simplify quite significantly.
And in terms of price, I mean, of course, not that specific prices, but what does it mean for the ranchers you work with? Is it, are you able to pay the same, similar, or different kind of contracts? Or is there actually, because of efficiencies of scale, you can offer lower prices to wholesale and actually at the end it doesn't change? Or maybe you're just able to buy
more. We're still early in that process, but I would say more of the latter. It really is that, you know, the way we're moving forward anyway is a way that can reward the producers for the benefits they're bringing to the landscape while taking advantages of the efficiencies of scale to still offer compelling prices to wholesalers. Don't know where that shakes out yet. Everybody, I mean, this is a paradox of humans. Everybody wants everything as cheaply as possible, free if they can. And then they turn around and complain at all the external consequences, you know, what economists would call externalities of that, that, you know, we pay through another channel. And so a lot of our thinking actually, which is the next layer here in the wholesale thing, one of the things that's emerged very, very strongly here is the early wholesale conversations focused on production attributes, you know, wow, grass-fed, regenerative, right? You know, tapping into the claims. They can get commodity elsewhere, but have very quickly evolved into what we call the plus data layer. And this is very highly driven.
It's meaning basically that the wholesale buyers or potential buyers, because you haven't signed anything or released anything yet, are interested on if you can get the regenerative beef, whatever that means, let's say the beef products, plus data on showing a lot of positive attributes, they are willing to pay a premium on top of the commodity prices that they could get elsewhere.
Yeah, and even, again, much yet to be proven.
Of course,
right?
Until, like, it all sounds nice. It sounds nice on paper until it's signed, yeah. But yeah, it's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I love your community, Kim, because everybody in this regenerative space needs, you know, it takes a bigger village as a thinking partner as we do this stuff. But what I can say is there's been a really massive pivot, and it's still early, but it's highly driven by the adoption of net zero targets from a climate impact perspective. I should know these numbers, something like a third of the world's market capitalization is now committed to some form of a net zero goal.
And we all know committing is easier than actually doing it. So they're all scrambling. Yeah.
And most of them have no clue how they're going to achieve it.
Especially
right?
Food companies. Yeah.
Especially food companies. And if you're even within the food company space, beef is the biggest problem, right? Because it's the one that has the biggest negative impact. And yet there's this weird paradox, right? And, you know, this is where my science comes in. Yes, beef has some of the biggest problems, but it also has the biggest opportunity to flip the script, right? You know, it's the old, it's the cow, it's not the cow, it's the how thing.
And do you see that? Because there's a massive lobby on just getting rid of beef. Do you see that understanding it's not the cow, it's the how within some of these corporates, like, do you, because of course you do, because otherwise they don't get to you at some point, but like a real understanding of it is that massive emission or CO2 equivalent. You see it in all the stats, right? And I'm gonna get angry emails now. I know most of those stats are not true. They're based on old LCAs. I know Rolf is gonna email, but that you see it in those stats, and then you say it also has the biggest flip side on the other side to actually probably together with grain and some of those crops, because it's just a massive acreage, to do something about it and actually be positive, or at least.
Yeah, and the trick is to get robustly, rigorously quantitative with it, right? So in the same thing.
So otherwise you just get George Monbiot and Alan Savory fighting on Twitter, which they do constantly, which is hilarious, but it doesn't get us anywhere.
It's not helpful, no. Right? It doesn't take us anywhere, right? So this is where the scientist and the engineer in me is like, okay, I get it. And I'm involved in a number of these leading science projects that are out there measuring things, but we have to get out of this mode of telling nice romantic stories with anecdotal success cases and build, if we're going to have an impact at scale and penetrate wholesale businesses and transform an industry, we've got to bring rigor and systems and processes and you know, robustness to this stuff so that when I deliver a container load of beef to somebody that says, you know, this was grazed in a way it's regenerative, well, A, just traceability and regenerative is proof, a challenge in its own right. But if they want to build on top of that, a data layer that says, and here's the improvement in the greenhouse gas footprint that comes along with this container load of beef, better expect to do that right, or you're going to get pushback, and rightfully so. And one of the things that excites me about building this kind of, you know, what some of my friends call digital MRV system in here is, I think, coupled with modern technology for tracing, et cetera, that credibility can translate value further back to the farmers and producers in this system. So, which maybe leads to the last level here. I spend a lot more time thinking at the system level than the product level and think about pragmatism and moving the needle rather than achieving perfection. And I can't remember what we talked about it before.
I should have really listened to it. I'm so sorry, listeners.
Yeah, me too.
It was an hour and 22, and it was a very busy week.
Yeah, yeah. But,
I've read the show notes, so but I do remember pieces of it because it's 3 years ago. So you might want to listen to it and get back to me what you thought.
These concepts were already in my mind. It's always
they were,
paradox.
But I'm curious, like what now, like on that rigor science piece, yeah. I have the feeling a lot is happening, but you're much deeper into that. So take us to the science land and where are we on looking at it's not the cow, it's the how. Like how, what are exciting things happening in the science space around that?
Let me finish the last thing real quickly and then I'll do that.
Of course.
Which is just to say that the thing that I don't recall if was in there before is, it's funny, sounds funny coming from a grass-fed beef guy, but the largest negative impact of beef production isn't even in the feedlot. It's in the cow-calf system that feeds the feedlot. This is what's causing me to go back at the system level and say, how can I implement business systems that can incentivize and reward producers?
So you're saying actually, just to unpack, because in the feedlot and the CAFO industry, the cows do start on pasture.
Correct.
When they're young and small. And you're saying the biggest impact, negative impact is there and not even in the grain feeding industry.
Well, it's in the grain that feeds the feedlot too, but it's mostly on the pasture land. If people worried about methane, enteric methane, which I'm sure we'll talk about, most of the enteric methane, 75-80% of it, is from the calf stage before the animal ever gets to the feedlot, not the feedlot. So if you want to change soil carbon sequestration and improve footprints of methane, you got to address that upstream.
And you're saying that's possible. On the pasture,
yeah,
like
absolutely.
The change is possible on the
pasture. All this grazing management system, it doesn't matter. It doesn't require, you know, we've had this kind of illusory false dichotomy of grass-fed versus grain-fed in the system. And when you want to have the whole product through its whole life cycle get there, and, you know, a couple months ago you had the wonderful gentleman Stefan von Vliet on talking about nutrient density in the beef study stuff that they're doing. There's no doubt that the product of a fully pasture finished animal is going to be nutritionally superior and phytochemically rich and all that kind of stuff. But if what I'm trying to do is sequester carbon and reduce methane and all that kind of stuff, I want to work with every animal on every acre if I can. So how do I do that? This kind of layer of starting with wholesale, adding data layers, and then starting to think in systems is where we're at now. And the science side of this stuff, part of the challenge is it's still way harder than it looks for people, right? I can go out and take a soil sample and I can measure my soil organic matter and I can see I'm making progress. But I cringe every time I hear somebody say, and therefore I've sequestered enough carbon to fix climate change here in the next 10 years, right? You know, whatever they're... And it's not malicious.
Why do you cringe? Why do you cringe?
It's just so much more complicated to bring rigor to the system, especially if you want the George Monbiots of the world to take it seriously, you know, the critics of the world, the policymakers that listen to George. And so on that front, we've completed a project in the Southeast United States comparing regenerative and non-regenerative ranches. This is with Peter Bick, who I don't think has been on your podcast.
No, we should get him. Here's a dear friend. Carbon Cowboys, right? There's a new documentary coming, which I love.
Yeah, we got a new documentary coming out.
I love the trailer.
Excuse.
Okay, yeah, we're gonna make that happen.
We'll do that. Let's make that happen. But Peter led that project, and indeed, we saw systematic improvements in the regenerative ranches versus the conventional ranches, and so now we have, I don't know, half a dozen or more papers. There's one more paper that I'm still waiting on to get through the peer review process that has to do with birds, which is, of course, you know, a key interest of my own. And there is a kind of a punchline to that story. I won't, spill the beans on the actual data. But for all the things we go out and measure, water infiltration, carbon sequestration, even some of this advanced technology that I'm involved with that I'll mention in a minute, eddy covariance technology, flux towers, the thing that's the most obviously different, that you just like night and day, is bird population and diversity. It's just really remarkable. The birds are a wonderful index. So there's one more paper that'll be coming out to document that results. There are other new projects starting. My good friend, Dr. Jason Rountree at Michigan State University, has launched what's currently a $19.2 million project, looking at ranch sets in Oklahoma, Wyoming, and Michigan, and contrasting carbon uptake and various things in pasture-based systems. That project is just about a year underway. And I talked to Jason a couple days ago, and he's already drowning in data.
On that system. From like one level up, that data, is it... I'm not saying beef is going to save the world and we can sequester all carbon we ever emitted in 10 years by ranching. What does it tell you? Is it in line with what you've been thinking, or do you have to rethink and now we have to focus on goats or ducks or something else or plant-based? Like, what does it tell you that these research you've seen, is it in line with what you've seen and is the optimism grounded, or do we need to listen more to the Monbiots of this world?
No, I think the optimism is still grounded. I think that what we're filling in data that is remarkably consistent with some of our expectations. When you do that, you got to make sure that you're not getting the expectations because you biased the research to do it, right? It's got to be done rigorously and defensibly. But so far...
Which is what a lot of the critics keep complaining about, like there's no studies, there's no, and then the savories get very angry, and there's just a whole fight. And you're saying that the studies partly are there, are coming, and are actually showing a lot of the things we've been saying.
Yeah, but they're still anecdotal, right? Yeah. So, you get a lot of visibility for major studies like the one Jason and Paige and the team did on
white oak
pastures, right?
I don't remember her name. This is really bad. I'm so bad with
Paige names. Stanley, maybe?
No, we didn't have Paige. We had... she's a farmer
Mariko.
As well. Mariko. Yeah, we had Mariko.
Yeah, Mariko.
Yeah, I think which was fascinating about LCAs.
I enjoyed that conversation. It's really good. Great. I still haven't talked to her. And if you're listening, give me a call.
She's been busy with other things, I can tell you. But yeah, that was a really interesting one. Anyway, that study, got blown up with infographics saying carbon negative beef is possible or emission equivalent, and led to a lot of excitement and pushback.
Yeah, and it is possible. I mean, but that's the trick, right? It's still only 3,000 or 4,000 acres in southern Georgia, right? And the study we've done in the southeast U.S. with these five sets of ranch pairs is let's just take another 10,000 acres, right? We have 650 million acres of grassland in America, so what we can't say is by studying that ranch in Georgia and these five ranches and other surrounding states, that we know this is true universally everywhere, right? That's a legitimate criticism. And so we keep adding ranches, but it's expensive to add ranches, right? And it takes time.
And it takes these fancy towers you're going to talk about soon. Yeah.
Yeah. So like these towers, one of the things, like in time, you know, we take, the way we do this now, right, is we'll take samples and we'll come back 5 years later and take samples, right? Well, that means you got to wait 5 years, not counting the analysis and interpretation. That's a long time.
It's a long time. And at the same time, people are like, okay, what does it, when does it plateau? And, but the interesting angle there, I think, is that like how many hectares currently or acres are currently under quote unquote regenerative management or have been for a number of years and how many haven't. So I think we're going to not run out of acres anytime soon of grasslands to do this.
No, we're not going to run out of acres anytime soon. And I know I'll get in trouble. I hope you don't get the hate mail, but
we get very, don't start with it, but we get very little actually. So
it's every time I run back of the envelope numbers, emphasis back of the envelope, we would run out of carbon in the air before we run out of places to put it in soil on the planet. If we really adopted regeneration at a planetary scale.
And you still think the grasslands are the big lever here, the biggest?
Grasslands and savannas. Grasslands are a big lever because they're about 2/3 of the world's agricultural land. Savannas are underappreciated. I think we got into this very binary, monolithic farmland versus ranchland dichotomy.
And savannas, what is a savanna?
Well, let's say silvopasture is the modern word for a reconstructed savanna, right? You're integrating grass and permaculture and forestry systems together. I think there's massive.
Which is very beautiful, by the way. Like to the human eye, it's a very pretty system.
But what you're doing there is in places where you have more moisture, which the trees require, and you can develop those multi-layer canopy systems, you're capturing more solar energy coming in, and you're cycling it in more layers of life, which is why, this is the physics of why I think ultimately regeneration is the only future for the planet, because this is what the planet wants to do. It's all of nature. It wakes
29
up every
minutes
morning,
in
literally.
And we get to the deep stuff.
All of nature wakes up every morning trying to figure out how do I catch just one more drop of sunshine, and it may be missing water, it may be missing a micronutrient, it may be missing a layer of biodiversity. Having a chat with my good friend Jonathan Lundgren here just yesterday and helping appreciate that even soil carbon, I think there's an underappreciated role of insects and arthropods, worms and bugs and dung beetles and all that stuff in the soil that are churning that system, making room for more and more carbon, freeing up more and more nutrients to grow more and more plants.
And even the plants, I read a piece of John Kempf, I'll put it below, on how little or how much unmet potential like potential we haven't really tapped into, untapped potential, of plants we have in photosynthesis. Like how much thriving plants do photosynthesis more than non-thriving ones, and how little we understand it. And thus how much solar energy we can actually turn into sugar and turn into root exudates that feed the soil. And there's so much there to dive into.
There is so much there, and it really is. I mean, one of the phrases we've used for years is the three-story acre. We certainly see regenerative ranchers and farmers recognizing that when they start producing healthy soil, they can grow more forage to feed more cows, to grow more forage. You get in this system where you can start adding effectively free acres to your production system by changing the way you think and behave and interact.
Which is tricky for people to understand because we grasp because people are like, okay, this is the carrying capacity that the model tells me or whatever university I have nearby. And then you see somebody pushing the system and at some point having three times as much. And you're like, what is he feeding them at night? Like, how is that going? How is it even possible? And somebody's cheating here. And it's the management. And unless you see that and try to grasp that, and it's very difficult to put that in a spreadsheet, of course, but that's where quote unquote returns are to do it with the same acreage, which is what all the critics rightfully say. Like, we need to produce more on the same acreage or even less. But it's possible without going to a lot of precision fermentation and other tech. Like, this is, but it's very, until you see the numbers and you see a farm in transition like that and you effectively see that somebody isn't bringing a truckload of food at night, it's difficult to believe even. Do you see that as well? That skepticism around more within even like regenerative boundaries?
Yeah, but that's why data is so valuable, yeah. Right? And the problem is we're now at the stage, you know, maybe this to keep the conversation moving this direction where we have a lot more science to do. We really do need to do science, but what we need to do now is more application of what we do know into scalable production systems where we can start attaching data that is defensible to real world cases and make that visible to more and more people. And, you know, it's
what's missing there? Is it that wholesale is now finally getting interested and so you can start gathering more? Is it not enough ranchers that have gone through their journey or under journey? What's the barrier there for the grasslands at least?
A couple of things. I don't think it's the ranchers and producers, by the way. I think that part's going pretty well.
Nobody's going back, it seems, as well. Like once you're on the train, like nobody goes back in, like once you're on this ranching transition train, it's very, in general, it seems rarely that you say, no, this doesn't work. Bring out the NPKs again.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to unsee regeneration once you get it. And I think on the producer's side, it's still hard work, but I marvel at the success of my friends like Dr. Alan Williams and Gabe Brown at Understanding Ag and educating farmers in a peer-to-peer way, right? The actual applied stuff. And, you know, gee, I wish I could push a magic button and have every farmer in America and the world go regenerative tomorrow. But that part, I think, is already on its own exponential. It's going, it's
research. Replicating. I mean, I'm saying everything, but you can get... We're in a time where you can YouTube a lot of this stuff. I'm not saying that you can YouTube how to do it in your context, but at least you can see where it's possible elsewhere. You can attend trainings online. You can that launch pad is is getting better every day, and
it feeds itself.
Yeah, it feeds itself, and then so that's not the barrier. So what is the barrier? Is there a barrier, or is it just getting shit done? Yeah.
Well, honestly, I see. The huge opportunity here with all these large food companies that now have net zero goals and
very lofty regen goals as well. Yeah.
Very, very, very lofty goals. Yeah, exactly. They all have the goals. And I think my sense is they're all sincere. I mean, there may be some people just playing the games, you know, I'm just going to milk these people for stuff. But my general sense in talking to folks, and this is my experience in large corporations, everything big blank is bad, right? You know, big ag, big food, big pharma, pick your bigot big. Yeah. They're just people like you and me. They're trying to do the best they can with what they see and make things move. But in reality, they don't know how to do this one yet, which is to how to bring defensible, rigorous, quantitative claims into their supply chain so they're not the ones that end up on the cover of The Guardian next to George Monbiot next week.
Next to Vera carbon credits, yeah.
Exactly. Vera forestry carbon credits, perfect example, right? You know, And yet, at the same time, say...
And a quantity that makes sense, not just a small little pilot. We see that here a lot. Like, okay, like if you look at what they spend on it, and like it's a few hundred hectares or a few hundred thousand, even if you're a large one, and it's just like, let's do a pilot and we do something. Right. And then it's so small that it's almost laughable, but it's not, of course. Like, how do you actually integrate this into a supply chain and web and start rewarding for this as well, which is a very difficult topic, of course.
Right, but that's where we're turning our attention now for exactly these
the money
reasons.
Is there. I mean, the companies that made the money in this last 4, 5, 10 years are definitely normally large.
Yeah, they're definitely interested. I think there's still challenges within that because...
Is the consumer ready? Oh. Are they going to reward them for doing this really difficult work?
Yeah. Everybody still wants the free and cheap, right? You know, it's like, I want my completely regenerative supply
burger,
chain.
And
you have to realize that's a goal we get to, not a place we start. One of the things, and I'll avoid this big rabbit hole, only use an example that's changed since the last time we talked, is I now have my own regenerative energy system on the house. I have my own solar panels, my own batteries on the garage wall, and I have all this geeky data that I can track and see all this stuff. And it's remarkably similar to how I look at flux tower data in a pasture for carbon. It really is the same thing. And now we're
going to double click on that. What's a flux tower? I knew I had to get to the tower. But why do you, because of course you come from the energy space, why do you see, because you've said that before, I saw similarities and that's why I'm in this space with soil profile. What is the similarity here?
Yeah, so a flux tower is based on a scientific field called eddy covariance. And basically think of it like an electricity meter that would be on your house, counting things moving in and out in real time. But instead of counting electrons, it's counting carbon and water.
Yeah, because you have these little devices that sort of listen to the electricity flow and can tell you even like, we think that the dishwasher is on, or we like they can even like they can monitor it pretty well, which I always sounds like magic, but at least it knows what is flowing in and out. Of course, in and out is funny because 20 years ago there was nothing in and out, it was just coming in, and now right. with your production and your batteries and a grid connection, there's a constant flow, and you're saying this is literally a tower. So if we're an audio yeah. medium, so I should imagine like a few meters, like what's tower,
yeah, several meters. Just think a few meters, 3 or 4 meters tall. Think of it as a glorified weather station, if okay. you will. And instead but of
something
what we
that
do
looks
today,
down, or something that senses or sniffs, or how does it?
It basically think of it like a ticket taker at a concert that just watches what's going past it as things go up and down.
I've seen this in the Amazon forest. I think they put them on big,
yes, exactly.
like these platforms on top of the tree lay, and then they measure the flow up and down.
Same kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. The technology is the same. The math is the same. The sensors are the same. The trick is that thing you see in the Amazon is generally a very, very expensive scientific instrument, and it's not real practical for deployment. But we, as a part of this project in the Southeast United States, we had 3 pairs of flux towers out on 3 of the ranch combinations. 2 managed under a scientist from the University of Illinois, and 2 with a University of Exeter in the UK. And we did some advanced comparisons on that one with some commercial things in the real way. And importantly, just to underscore the point, instead of like measuring carbon and coming back and measuring carbon again 5 years from now, I can watch the carbon going in and out all day, every day.
You can see the grass breathe, basically.
You can see the grass breathe, right? And every day when the sun comes up, the carbon gets sucked in like a vacuum cleaner. And what's really interesting at night, we're learning some scientific things like, just to give you one anecdote on the pair in southern Mississippi with the flux towers, the difference between the regenerative farm and the non-regenerative farm had less to do with how much carbon went in by day. It had more to do with how much carbon left by night.
So you plucked the hole in the bathtub, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. You basically have enough biology in the soil that's living that can make use of all that root exudation.
So it's not the problem of getting it out and getting it into the soil. It's the problem of getting it into the soil and keeping more of it there because of life.
Keeping more of it there, right? Yeah. So biologically, it'd be an anabolic process instead of a catabolic process, right? Anabolic is what we do with steroids and muscles, right? We try to get it so they accumulate mass. And that's what we're trying to do with soil as well. And now with flux tower technology, we can see that happening. In some of the tower pairs in the northern regions of our area, we could see the difference of like cover crop strategies. Basically, with a cover crop, right, I can increase the shoulders of production, right? I can have more green growing early in the spring and more green still growing in the fall, right? Anywhere you see green, that means carbon is going down. And then, per the other comment, am I holding on to it with healthy soil, or is it just being chewed up by microbes and sent back into the air by night? With this kind of technology, we can do that. So where we see this going, and what I honestly think is the biggest gap in this space now that we have appetite from large companies that care about this stuff, is how do we bring credible, affordable, scalable measurement to traceable supply chains in this system. And, once again, probably an area where I hope I don't inspire hate mail in this system. There's a lot of companies that think that my magic technology can count carbon and, we're done and I can go sell you a carbon credit. And my deep experience from the oil and gas industry, where counting carbon in the deep earth was specifically my deepest expertise, says, no, the way we're going to do this is just like a hospital. There's a blood sensor and there's a heart sensor and there's other things that it's the integration of different data types that's going to help us understand the health of the patient here. So we're going to be integrating physical samples of soil, flux towers,
And these flux towers now became possible because they became much, much cheaper as some other sensors did.
I guess I skipped that important part. This team at the University of Exeter, and with a disclaimer here, I'm an advisor to the company now called Quantera. They've basically very significantly reduced the cost of deploying these towers in farm settings. So just in the first year of operations last year, set up 52 flux towers, 44 of those in the U.S., and we're getting data. And
what else do you get apart from like carbon that passes? Like what other exciting gases pass through the air above the grass?
Well, basically any gas you measure, you can count. Mm-hmm. And kind of the ones you get as the base case are carbon and water. So moisture, I can watch the rainfall with rain gauges, but it's really fun to quantitatively watch the moisture evaporate.
Which is massively under, of the cooling capacity of this earth. It's something we have, I think we had.
Cooling capacity, water utilization. I do indeed. It's not priority one right now, but I actually think we will learn a lot about cooling cycles here. I have my own ideas. Since our last conversation, I had a good conversation with one of my scientific heroes in this space, Dr. Axel Clyden at the Max Planck Institute. He's the head of the biogeochemistry division. And we're talking about this water, you know, and cooling. And he's also a flux tower expert in the system. And it's just so darn hard. it really is hard to quantify and measure, and it's hard to forecast. But what I can say, if I zoom out to the first principle physics, over there on my bookshelf is a textbook that he wrote on how Earth works as an energy system. And these flux towers basically give us the ability to watch this in real time. So much energy comes in, so much gets captured by the plant, so much goes out. And there's this balance between energy, basically heat stored as heat stored in moisture, what we call sensible and latent heat, and radiative heat going in and out of a system. And when you kind of close the loops on all this stuff, you start to understand, well, what is the surface of the earth doing? And when we're talking regeneration, mm-hmm. what we're really talking about is managing the surface of the earth in a way that increases its capacity to capture more sunshine tomorrow than it did yesterday. And by the way, in the process of doing that, the way it does that is it continues to accumulate more carbon and hold on to more water in that regenerative system. That's what regeneration is scientifically.
Which gives us the cooling. But I mean, we're going to do a series on water cycles soon-ish. And that's, I think, it's one of the big non talked about except in some scientific circles, like story. Like this is, we had Walter Jenner on, of course, and I've touched mm-hmm. upon it a few times here and there, but probably the water cycle is way more interesting than the carbon cycle because it's where a lot of the heat transaction takes place. And that's what we're suffering from now. That we, I think Judith Schwartz said that in our first interview, like we de-vegetized this earth for a large extent and took away a lot of that healthy skin that we had that was regulating temperatures, and we're feeling the issues with that now.
That's exactly right. But what I would say is that the principles are actually fairly straightforward, but the complexity of how they implement in the real world is actually quite complicated. And that's why we don't have a better grip on it right now. So
what do you mean about that in terms of why is it complicated in the...
Because the water goes up and it evaporates, it rejects the heat in the upper atmosphere, it changes clouds, it comes down. You know, so we understand some local things.
There's so we cannot say yet, like this tree will lead to X more rainfall in Y and X less heating to X less heating to that and less snow in this case and thus more radiation or less, etc. It's a very complex living system.
It's in very simple models. Like Dr. Clyden wrote a paper more than 20 years ago now, documenting that if you basically just synthetically take all the deserts of the world and turn them into green plants that are growing and respiring and sending water back into the air, the surface of the planet would drop about 7 degrees Celsius. That's a lot.
Yeah.
But it's very simple model, right? So what happens in reality? What variables are we accounting for? How does that all fit together? We can see things now. I actually think there's increasing credibility, even though I know there's controversy in things like the biotic pump and rainforest. I'm sure you've talked to Judith about that, mm-hmm. Walter. But even like using these eddy covariance data, Dr. Paul Stoy, he used to be at Montana State. I think he's recently moved to Wisconsin, documented some great cases in the agricultural lands and prairies of Canada, where if for fallow land compared to land that was still growing something, right, bare soil versus mm-hmm. growing something, that you could document a 1 or 2 degrees Celsius difference in surface temperature. Well, all of our climate change conversation is around 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius differences, right?
Yeah, no, so, it's a massive one. I think it becomes such, like, let's say you do, but it begs the question, you're in a rangeland state or in a place, and like where do you need to intervene first, and how much of it do you need to touch to significantly alter, I would say, local climate, but to stabilize or to take some of the peaks out, because that's what we're suffering from: peaks of rain, peaks of drought, peaks of temperature, and all of that, like climate weirding, somebody called it, which I think is a nice term. Like, how do you, because one farm is not going to be enough. Like, one field is not, for the field, yes, but around it, like, what's the...
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, you can change your farm, but it's not going to change the weather in a region. But if you change all the farms in a region, then you might actually start changing the weather. There's this famous rabbit-proof fence photos of Western Australia where the vegetation on the ground seems to impact cloud cover in the system. You've got biotic pumps. We've got these anecdotes. Yeah. Once again, we have anecdotes.
But this is too important to only have anecdotes.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but it's also hard. I think there's going to be generations of scientists that are going to do this.
But it shouldn't stop us from doing, like, it shouldn't stop us from acting and asking those questions.
Like, or actually implementing, right? There, you know, implementing regenerative agriculture is a no-brainer on the ground, right? I mean, there's like nothing that should stop us from implementing regenerative agriculture as quickly as we can. Because it pays. I don't care if you're interested in birds or carbon or water or farmer profitability or human health, you know, pick your angle, right? You touch on many of them in your podcasts. And so, you know, this is where I strongly agree with the advocates is like, yes, we should go as fast as we can. On the other hand, I would say, meanwhile, we should gather as much data as we can so we can understand it, so we can do it better. And, you know, this is going to sound really crazy. I think our biggest impediment as a species now is we've unwittingly built a civilization designed to fight against the natural forces of the planet. And the future of this planet will only be viable for us and the planet if we figure out how to work with the natural forces. That's what regenerative farmers are doing, is they're figuring out how to let nature do the hard work for them. And when we do that, I think we will be rewarded. We will be happy. We will be healthy. it'll sound like heresy, but, you know, there's so much conversation about the carrying capacity of planet Earth. But if I step back into thermodynamic terms, the carrying capacity of planet Earth is not a fixed variable. If we manage it differently, we can actually raise the ceiling. And that's hopeful to me. So others, it's heresy. But to me, it's just thermodynamics. It's a massively overabundant flow of energy from a nuclear reactor placed at a safe distance in the sky called the sun that shines down on every acre of planet Earth every day. And life that wants to grow, but humans currently tend to have a bad habit of killing it.
Killing what wants to grow and trying to make something grow that doesn't want to grow. Yeah.
Yeah. So once we learn how to help what wants to grow and how to find balance, not either or binary, you know, systems, which we've had, you know, it's a weed, kill it. Right. Then I think that there's a future for the planet. The birds will come back and you know, people will be healthy again. There'll be nutrition in our food because the soils are active. You know, I don't think we're missing you know, micronutrients in very many soils, I think we're missing the biology that makes those micronutrients available to the plants to want to grow, and that limits plant capacity. It's remarkable to me what happens when microbiology is fed and driven in that thin skin called soil on planet Earth. And regenerative agriculture is the way we're going to do that. And then if we can bring through the science, you know, farmers go as fast as they can. If we can bring through the science ways of quantifying that and making that impact visible, you know, the way I describe our high level strategies in standard soil is use biology first, close the loops and make impact visible. That's, you know, I think broadly probably a more apt description of kind of what we need to do as a planet or as a society than anything else. But that's how my brain thinks about all this.
And I remember last time we touched upon that as well. And like you said something, I'm going to paraphrase, like as a species, like if we don't regenerate Earth, another species will. Like it's so inevitable that this longing for nature or the like, these processes go towards entropy, to complexify, to take more sunlight, and to turn it into something useful. Do you still feel that way? And if so, why? And if not, why as well?
Yeah, no, I absolutely still feel that way because the laws of the physics are the same. What life is and what evolution tries to do is get better and better at capturing solar energy and cycling it in life every day. That's why I think regeneration is inevitable. And we arrogant Homo sapiens, you know, thought we were clever enough to conquer nature, control it, and nature bites back, right? And so what I think regenerative farmers are learning every day is when they learn how to see and understand and adapt to nature. My good friend, Dr. Alan Williams, is always underscoring the importance of adaptive in regeneration, right? Regeneration is not a recipe. It's not a three-step program that you go out and implement and you're done. It's a way of thinking and interacting with landscapes and ecosystems that can change how we grow food and fiber. And you know, the engineer in me then looks at that, and that's where most of the acres of human managed land on the planet are, is in farming. And so I do think it's inevitable. And I think we'll either get good at working with nature or nature will put us on unemployment, if you will, and
fired,
replace us with other species that help serve its, you know, functional goals of capturing more and more solar energy. Because those forces are so overwhelmingly powerful compared to anything we humans touch that I really think it's our choice.
And what do you say then to the critics? And I want to double click also on the nutrient side. We talked about it last time, but let's get to that later. What do you say to the critics that say we have to intensify with as much technology and then spare as much land and let it rewild, or very like the technology angle to this these challenges, the Monbiots, but there are many others as well. What do you, sure. I'm not saying you should say something, but How do we connect with them? Because it's very easy to fight on Twitter and to write a very annoying response on LinkedIn, which I sometimes do when somebody shows our world in data about CO2 emission equivalent, like it's equivalent and it's based on all the LCAs, etc. But that's not very effective. I recognize that. What do you do when in a room you do a presentation or you share something and somebody says, yeah, but what about this and this technology or this and this? And that this is going to create a lot of proteins and then we don't need all that grassland and all those animals on it, which is usually like, okay, then we can just let it become nature or something. That's sort of usually the standard approach. And I'm curious, what is your go-to story there or answer there or response?
Yeah, well, asking for a friend. My current go-to may not be perfect yet. I probably got a lot of room to improve on it. But what I try to help people understand is it's not an either-or problem. You know, this is the old sparing versus sharing mentality. And sure, if we humans have an either-or mentality, then the right thing to do would be to spare the land, put our destructive human forces behind a fence, and limit their impact. But if we humans understand the thermodynamics of how the planet works and the opportunity to be a part of those natural forces in the ecosystem, then we can adopt a sharing mentality where, you know, every acre of land is a working acre in some way, and we humans have an opportunity to touch it in a way that helps it or hurts it. And once we understand how to help it, the overall capacity of the planet is good. So I think this kind of rewild and leave some land for somebody else as a place, it's inherently tied up in the very philosophy that got us into the problem in the first place. It still may be appropriate. I mean, I'm grateful that we've had conservation efforts that have kept ecosystems intact, even if they're what my good friend Marshall Johnson at the National Audubon says he describes them as habitat museums, right? You know, that we cannot save nature by having habitat museums, but thank God we have habitat museums where we've saved enough of nature that it can come back from again. So I don't know that I've won any converts with that yet. I'm giving a talk here next month, actually, to the Texas Academy of Math, Engineering, Science, and Technology. And I'm probably going to have a concise way to describe that in this system. But once, you know, I think we can keep it really simple on the farm level. You know the stories, you hear them, you see them. Once people see a regenerative farm compared to a conventional farm, you go, I want more of that, right? You know, I want, because it's a living, breathing ecosystem, and you don't need a flux tower to notice a butterfly or a bumblebee. And I think we can focus on that now. And then I think the role, so I strongly agree with my good friends, Jonathan Lundgren, Richard Teague, is the role of science here is to come in and observe and learn from leading farmers. It's not to come in and tell leading farmers what to do. And if we can bring science in that observational role where we can shape the evolution of knowledge so people can understand that it really isn't an either or, that there is an opportunity to get a rare win-win in this system. I think that's what we need to focus on. And I realize that's a long game. There's no, like, I'm not going to set up a flux tower or take a soil sample or write a report, a blog or whatever, that's going to be the be all, the end all in this system. But I'm going to take the opportunity to take every sample, do every analysis, talk to every farmer. At the same time, in a practical world, when I'm working here with the focus is, you know, I believe in the potential positive power of business to be an ally to make this happen. So how do we get out of this acrimonious debate and the either or stuff and break this cheap at all costs mentality and start getting, let's stop chasing perfection. Let's stop chasing best. Let's chase better. And let's work towards bringing better into the system. And we'll define better first with attributes. And as soon as we can, we'll start attaching quantitative data to it. And then better, better, better. And at some point, you know, it's going to seem really small, but then at some point it's going to look like, holy cow, regeneration came out of nowhere, is now a major part of our food system. So that's really the overall goal in this system and where my mind is in terms of trying to figure out how do we bring scale to this stuff. Something like Blue Nest Beach was just a place to start. And I think, you know, we're a part of a bigger picture on our own, but a part of a much, much bigger community now that people like you are growing internationally, trying to figure out how do we do this at scale? Because it just won't do us any good if White Oak Pastures is, you know, alive here and the rest of us are staring at dead, sterile topsoil across the rest of America. You know, hats off to Will Harris and his team. They're doing amazing work, but we got to figure out how to adopt and implement these principles and make it rewarding for the farmers to do this all across America and across the world. So anyway,
I'm laughing because it's such a perfect end to this interview, but that's why I never say let's ask the question later, because then I have to do it. But I do want to double click for a second on, even sorry, this is a perfect end of this interview, but I want to spend a few minutes on the nutrient density, the flavor side of things, because we talked about it before actually in the other interview, and I just want to see if your thinking, what you have been observing over the last 3 years. You mentioned Stefan, of course, we put the interview in the description below. What is your take on where we're at to show healthy soil leads to healthy produce or products, and then to healthy gut systems and healthy people? Is that as exciting? Are you excited about it? Still excited?
I'm very excited about it, but I would say I'm excited about it because some other people have adopted it as a primary focus, and they're doing good science and they're advancing that cause. So I'm not too deeply involved in it. Stefan Van Vliet really has you know, done rigorous objective science and is doing more every day, and in part in collaboration with my friends Eric Jackson and Dan Kittredge at the Bionutrient Food Association. We'll have Dan will be one of our keynote speakers at the GrassFed Exchange this year, September, in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And they're together doing this beef study, right, where they're going out to something like 400 regenerative farms and measuring nutrient density and trying to map it to soil health and grazing practices. And, you know, when I talked to Dan, it's probably been 6 weeks or 8 weeks ago or so now. I'm like, it's like, I don't know what that data is going to say yet, but I have a pretty good hypothesis. Yeah. And I think, you know, the evidence that, you know, we hear being reported intermediately from Stefan is valuable in here. I do think this is, before I even heard the word regeneration, it's why for my family's household, we got into grass-fed, pasture-based food system.
And is that interesting for these large, do you have these kind of conversations with wholesale?
No.
Or not yet? Okay.
Not yet. For what it's worth, probably the place where I separate, I think it would be fabulous if we could sell nutrients instead of pounds of anything, because I think that's what people want. In fact, I think it's the focus on pounds that has created this massive distortion of you know, the ratio of pounds per nutrients gotten out of whack. And I don't care whether it's a bag of Doritos or just an oversized tomato that doesn't taste like anything. It's we've done it in all of those system. So I would love it if we can succeed in doing that. But maybe this is my own skill set because I come from the background of counting carbon and sediment originally, which I appreciate is hard enough. But human nutrition is such a complicated science to start with that I think that's probably going to be a long journey as well before we can really map farming practices to food quality to human health and have data that we can stand behind. So
probably as complicated as water cycles and
yeah, yeah, exactly. I continue to applaud, you know, these great folks like Dr. Van Vliet and Dan and Eric and others in this space. And I'm glad they're doing it. And I hope to, you know, take advantage of that perhaps someday. But no, it's not central in any of our current Fair activities enough, yeah. and plan. It's not in the conversation yet. So,
which means I should have ended with that other piece, but we didn't because I promised to ask a question. So with that, I want to thank you so much for your time. Always a pleasure to have you on. Talk about your work, talk about what you're seeing, observing, what you're involved in. And I hope it's not going to be another 3 years before we redo this. So thank you so much for the work you do, for showing up here, and for the sharing you've done until now.
Thanks, Ken. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.